Session number 1679, Mr. William Ridley, reel 17.
Mr. Ridley, reel 17. You mentioned in the last tape, Mr. Ridley, the APAT patrols. Was that some kind of code name for the patrols?
I don't know what APAT stands for. I suppose there's an abbreviation for AP and sort of thing. Army Patrol, something like. But what it was the carrier platoon used to carry out sweeps between the in no man's land. At this particular time we were about 20 miles away from the German front lines, and there used to be night patrols going out, and the battle patrol used to go out and sneak in and roll the grenades into their dugouts and things like that. But on the APAT patrol was three carriers used to go out every day, and they used to sweep. Now I'm not sure whether it's in front of the South African they used to sweep in front of and behind, but mostly in front of the South African armoured cars, and they used to go and sometimes taunt them and what have you, and just about out of reach of the guns and what have you. But there was one particular patrol we went out on, and we pulled out pretty just after stand two in the front line, and we lagered up for about half an hour in a little gully like, and then we proceeded towards the German front line. The sergeants and the crews of the carriers were adept, and they knew exactly where to go and how far to go. There was always one of the intelligence section with them on these patrols, just for us to get used to what the front was like. In this particular time, we had a new officer. Now, I can't remember the name of the officer, but the sergeant was in the we went out with three carriers, with a sergeant in charge, and also on one of the carriers was always an officer, but the sergeant used to always be point carrier, and he was very expert in this field, and when he got near the front line, naturally, he slowed the carriers down to a practically a walking pace. The reason for this was that the desert, and with the constant patrolling of carriers, was a lot of the tracks was pounded into like a powder. It always reminded me of just like flour, and it used to come up on top of you and your eyes all turned red, and your lips, you just think you had lipsticks on your lips with the moisture from your mouth, and the dust, and the pink dust used to turn to red on your lips. And this particular time we knew that if we went near the crashed Stuka or the upturned carrier or whatever, these were landmarks that the Germans had their guns zeroed on, and we knew if you went near these, they used to open up and they could drop one, could quite possibly drop one in the middle of your carrier. So the sergeants and the regular lads that used to go out were careful not to get near these points, and to crawl along at a snail's pace was to avoid the back trail of dust, which naturally aroused the German observation posts. So Jobson, I call him, Sergeant Jobson, and Sergeant Jobson was coming along very, very carefully along with the two carriers in arrow formation, him in the point, and I was with Sergeant Jobson. And all of a sudden, the carrier that the officer was in come rushing up the other, and he says, "What's the matter, Sergeant?" He says, "Nothing, sir." He says, "Why are you running so slowly?" He says, "Well, sir," he says, "they'll spot me, and he says they'll drop a few shells on top of you." He says, "What's the matter? Are you afraid, Sergeant?" He says, no, sir. He says, "I'm not afraid." He says, "I'm just careful." And he says, "Nothing to begin to get blown out of the desert for really on a patrol like this," or words to that effect. So he says, "Well," he says, "best thing for to do," he says, "to take my position in the flank." He says, "Now I'll take point." So They swapped places, and the officer came in the second man's seat. I was in the back behind the driver. And, "Right, driver, put your foot down." And the driver put his foot down. And we got about a half a mile. And all of a sudden there was three shells dropped. Plonk, plonk, plonk in front of us, right in front of the carrier. And the officer, turn round, quick. And unfortunately, on this particular carrier, one of the tracks wasn't working correctly, because the carrier more 9 times out of 10 can turn in its own length, but this time the brake on the track was not working, and it took them about 100 yards to turn round, and the egg on the, by this time the egg on the officer's face was starting to dry, I think, but he panicked, and I think he was one officer that learned the lesson to take notice of the likes of the sergeants who were out there every day, and he came in for one day, and he was so clever, but I've never seen such a man, such a panic to get out of the road after that.
You don't recall his name?
I don't know the officer's name, definitely don't know. He was a new man, and I don't know where he comes from. He was a new guy, but I remember Sergeant Jobson, and he was a good sergeant. He was a big 6 foot bloke, and he was a good sergeant. If you can call a sergeant kind and gentle, he was kind and gentle, like, you know. But the opposite to what sergeants are normally are, like, sort of thing.
When you came back from patrol, did you have to report in and give a report of what you'd done and seen, and etc.?
Just talked it over, probably with the intelligence officer, like, you know, the intelligence sergeant. But the main news went through the sergeant that was in charge. We were more or less there just as observers, and, you know, see what was going on, like, you know. But the thing is, in the desert, everything looks the same, you know. I mean, you could go back the next day and it looked completely different, like, you know. Speaking for myself, I used to love it. I used to love being, I think it must be the cowboy in us, I think.
There were different types of patrols. Are there the patrols that attacked and those that went out just to reconnaissance?
Well, the day the deer patrols, what we call the APAT patrols, used to go out, were out all day, and there was three carriers involved, and then they used to come in, they used to come in before stand down, like, you know, stand two rather, and then the battle patrol used to go out, and the battle patrol used to go, and they used to go out, and I think they used to go out in 1500 widths, and they used to drive maybe about 2 miles or 3 miles away from the German front line, and they used to go in and do a little bit of destruction, like running the dugouts and rolling grenades down into the dugouts and that sort of thing. And they were out every night. And to take something out of context, there was a corporal called Corporal Raisin, and he used to be out. He used to lead the patrol every night. That was his main function. And ahead of my story, but Corporal Raisin was a handsome bloke. He was only about 20, 21, and he used to be reserve goalkeeper for Grimsby, and that's it's not important that line, but this is how I remember them, like. I was once in charge of the guard at when we were in the box that we withdrew to after we got pushed back. No, when the 69th Brigade got annihilated.
The 150 Brigade.
When it got annihilated, we had to switch and come onto the flank, and we made a box on the flank of the thing, and there was only I think there was a section of 25 pounders with me, and just the battalion, I think. I'm not sure, mind, whether it was the full battalion or whether it was part of it, but I think it was the full battalion. And I was on, one night I was on sentry go, and as I was saying, Corporal Raisin used to be out every night in the dark and what have you. And this guy came up to me, and we challenged him, like, you know, and advanced to be recognised, and it was Corporal Raisin. And he says to me, "Where's the battle patrol stationed?" He says, "I'm completely disorientated." He says, "And this is the guy who is out all every night in the dark, and he just didn't know where he was, like, you know." And I says, "Well," I says, "just go through the gap, or to the end of the gap," and I says, "take it," and I give him a bearing from the mouth of the end of the, when he was through the minefield, and I says, "Go up so many hundred yards," and I says, "you'll find the battle patrol in the trenches there." And he left us, and the danger going through the gap in the minefield was that it was already set for to accept mines. In other words, the mines is piled on each side of the gap, so that if anything happened and we were on the outside of the thing, we withdrew in, and as we withdrew in, we were supposed to put the mines in their places as we went in to and then go inside the box. And it was a good hour or a half an hour to an hour after we had let them through, and there was a massive explosion, and I took one of the sentries to investigate, and Corporal Raisin had wandered onto the minefield, and he had hit a mine, and he was killed, and his head was, he was so close to being out of the minefield that his head was on the trip, more or less on the tripwire, on the thing. He was a matter of about 5 or 6 paces from getting through the minefield, and he was a smashing bloke, smashing lad, very quiet. But that's out of context. That was out of context.
Listening patrols, did they go out as well with a specific task?
We were out once or twice on listening patrol. We had one when we were in the front line in Gazala, but we were also, I was also in a one when we're in the box that I was just talking about. And one night I was lying in the dugout, and the sergeant come out, and Sergeant Davison come to us, and he says, I want you to go out on a listening post. I says, oh, this was at a time when they'd pushed the line right back to Burakim, where the Free French was. And the sergeant says, I want you to go out there and keep your ears open and what have you. I says, how many lads have I to take? He says, just one. So I took my sidekick, Bob Redshaw, and I wasn't particularly keen, because what a minefield to negotiate me to get out, like, you know. And it was a path, sort of. And they took us to the start of this path. And what it was it was a cable, a telephone cable. And it was stretched zigzag through the minefields, and the way you had to do it was you put the wire between your legs, and you put your feet directly under the wire, and you proceeded that way. And I would say it was a matter of about, the minefield was about, I would say about 40 yards deep. That's approximately, I couldn't be too sure, like, you know. And we negotiated this. I was leading Bob, and I come to the end of the wire, and the gap that I assumed was the gap was the matter of about 15 yards away. The problem was there was a path, a plain path, that came up from the exit, and it stopped about 15 yards away from where I was standing. Now the problem was, how do I go from the wire that was between me legs to the gap, which was obviously the path out. So I didn't know what to do, and there was only one thing for it, making a beeline for it. So I said to Bob, I says, go back about a few yards, I says, and lie down. I says, and he goes, both of us got no courage. And so he went back, and I travelled the longest 10 yards in my life getting from that wire to the opening in the thing. And obviously that was the way to go, like, but I wasn't too sure, like, you know. But anyway, it was naturally I wouldn't have been here if it hadn't have been right, like. But anyway, we got to the other side, and we'd had instructions that if we heard anything, we had to put a very light pistol, very light, up and arouse them. Well, we went out, and Bob says, well, he says, how far would it go? Well, I says, we'll do 1,000 yards, 1,000 steps, like, you know, sort of thing. And we'll just lie down on the deck, like, which we did. We eventually got there, and we took a bearing on we knew which where we bearing onto, where, you know, like, we marched on a bearing. And we kicked down for the night. So I was pretty much alive, tingling with terror. And I says to Bob, I says, you take the first stint, like, you know. But Bob was as hepped up as what I was, like, you know, and of course there was no sleep. And I saw more Germans that night, heard more footsteps that night than I've ever heard in my life. But bushes, little shrubs turned into massive blokes, and the eyes was seeing things that moving all over the place. And the slightest noise, the slightest rustle of caused panic stations in your mind and your heart, till about a quarter of an hour, half an hour before dawn. And all of a sudden we heard tank motors start up, and we listened, and I thought to myself, I got the very pistol, I loaded the very pistol, and I was lying there in front of us, and I thought to myself, if it comes this way, there's nothing going to stop them from coming over the top of us, like, you know, sort of thing. So we listened intently to the thing, and the sound seemed to come towards us. And it was a cold night, and the sweat was running off the enemy nose, and then it stopped, and then I heard the squeaking of the tracks and that, and then it started to go away to a left, and then it stopped, and then I heard the squeaking as if when the tank turns round, it's got like a queer squeaky clacky clacking noise, and it come again past the point where it actually started, and he went the other way, and gradually it faded away, and where it was going to was the Battle of Burakim. The next morning, that morning, was the start of the Battle of Burakim. And I think, I don't know about Bob, I think, but I think I lost about a couple of stone that night. With sheer terror.
It must be a very stressful situation lying there in the dark.
Well, it's like, if it does come, what are you going to do? All you got to do is fire the very light pistol, like, you know. But what do you do after that? Do you lie still? Do you scarper? I mean, there's nothing you can do with an infantry soldier against a couple of tanks at one time, you know. I mean, I had worked it out, like, we're all right as long as he doesn't come over the top of us, like, you know, sort of thing. But it was a bit hairy, I mean, I must admit, like, you know, I mean, but I'm a devout coward, you see.
Finding your way back to your lines in the dark in those situations, was it easy?
Well, you just turned to walk, marched on the, you know, if you went out at a I took 180, I think it was. I can't remember exactly, but I think it was 180, which is a good straight line sort of thing. Like, and I knew I would have to come back on 360 or something like that. Like, you know, I can't remember exactly what it was, but you knew if you went on 150, 180, you would have to come back on the double that, you know. It depend on what it was, but that's it. There was no problems because it was getting late by the time we'd come back. But I was on the verge. I was twice on the verge of firing the pistol, like, you know. And you're more frightened of firing the pistol and making an idiot of yourself and combined with the fear of what might happen, sort of thing. But I think the greatest fear was making a fool of yourself, you know, sort of thing, like, you know. And having only one stripe, I mean, I'll be back to private in no time flat.
When you returned, you would hand in some kind of report or make a report.
Well, there was not really nothing to report, only that what I, exactly what I told you. Like, you know, there was nothing really to say, because everything that we saw was all imagination. You know, I mean, as I say, we saw bushes move, but when the light come up and the thing that you thought was somebody moving was just a little tiny bush, like, you know, sort of thing, like, you know, because there is a good deal of shrubbery in the desert, like, you know. It's a beautiful place. It is really. I used to love the desert. I could have lived there.
Did you get involved in any of these larger columns that went out, the jock columns?
No, I was never on a jock column.
Usually about company size or something of that nature.
Yeah, well, there was one which ended in disaster.
And this was in your box?
And this is in the
battalion.
Oh, the battalion box. And it was at that, but it was the period before we went into the small box. And we got instructions that we were going out on a 3-day patrol. Now, to go out on a 3-day patrol was, it went out in block. It's like the old-fashioned square. And the square was, you had on each corner of your square, you had your anti-tank guns. Both us on each corner. In between, you had what in them days was a 2-pounder anti tank. I think it was a 2-pounder anti tank at that time. But there was anti tank on each side. We had carriers. Carriers patrol on each flank, in the front and in the back. What it was a box where whichever, and they had companies, they had truckloads of infantry on each side of the square, and in the middle you had the headquarters, medical staff. Company headquarters and all the unnecessary bodies was in the middle of the square. The object was, if you got attacked from any side, they had the same amount of firepower from either side of the square. And so anyway, we got this information, and we were all out of one of the gaps. I can't remember which one it was. There's some of them. I know it was the one at the rear. I'm not sure, because all the gaps had a name. Like,
do you recall the names of the gaps?
I think one was Gates, and one, you know,
Tyneside.
All Tyneside names, like, you know. And we went out through the gap because the battalion. Well, what it was that. Every section was more or less a little section on its own, and a platoon was another section on its own, and then the company was round that, and then around all the companies was another protective bits of minefields and things like that, and barbed wire and all, trip wires and what have you. And anyway, we went through that. There's this, I think it was a pontilion box, pontilion gap, or something like that, anyway. But it was the rear part of the box line. And we pulled out there, it was barely light. And the start to form up.